This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
You ready to make to come to the microphone so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, where I'm very pleased to have a return engagement from the author of the cult classic, The Search for Captain Zero, Cosmic Banditos, the film producer, director of Watertime, which I plan to bring to this audience via The Real Deal very soon, Alan Weisbecker, who's traveling around the country with his dog in search of truth, justice, and the American way, or what remains of it. Alan, welcome back to The Real Deal.
That's right. Thanks a lot, Jim. Yeah, I'm in mid-Texas somewhere in tornado country on my way to the Secret Space Program conference in Austin, which will be on the 31st of the 1st. And I'm really interested in that. I'm interested also in getting your take on some of the stuff about the conference. I'm going to sort of try to needle the people there, because I think they're sort of not seeing things the way they really are in terms of NASA and science and all that.
Are these people, Alan, by and large, who do understand that we faked the moon landing, or do they think we actually went?
That's a really good question. That's one of the reasons why I'm actually going there, is because they're smart people, like Catherine Austin Fitz, and a guy named John Brandenburg, a PhD, who just exposed the fact that there might have been a nuclear war on Mars, and he's a real serious PhD scientist that's, you know, run amok a little from the establishment. Phillips, they're all smart people. Joe Farrell, who's done some really interesting stuff on, there's some UFO aspects to it. And I know you don't really concentrate on that, but to answer your question about Apollo, you know, these people believe, and I'm, you know, they really have a lot of evidence, and they're not nuts. They're really smart researchers. They're convinced that there's a secret space program in the United States, and NASA is just bullshit and it's a front, which we know. And the real thing that's going on is there's a secret space program that may be back engineered from UFOs that crashed, or maybe not, or maybe was engineered from Nazi technology at the end of World War II. They're not sure about any of that, but they believe that it's very possible that we've been flying to Mars since the 60s or even the 50s. And all around the solar system with anti-grav kinds of technologies. And believe me, they have a lot of evidence that is true. But to answer your question, the really interesting thing about it is most of them just assume that Apollo was real. Now, that wouldn't bother me so much, you know, if they were, you know, any other kind of truth types. I mean, you know, somebody's into 9/11 and they think Apollo was real. You know, I could sort of understand that they haven't looked into it or whatever, but these people are really into, whatever, you know, space, the exploration of space and et cetera. And one of the first things that they should know is what you know, and it's so well put in your book, that we didn't go to the moon with Apollo. They would say that we've been to the moon and we have bases there even, but it makes no sense on a logical basis in this way. If the United States, let's assume that they're right, and they have a secret space program, that, and they've been flying to Mars and to the moon for 40 years, what sense would it make to have a real firecracker, chemical rocket space program that's complete bullshit like NASA, you know, like Apollo, or even the International Space Station? Why? I mean, in other words, you'd save the money and fake it like they did. Do you understand what I'm saying? In their, under their own logic about the fact that there's a secret space program, it makes no sense that they believe in Apollo or even in the International Space.
Well, I'm just wondering if you take your copy of, and I suppose we didn't go to the moon either with you, are you going to risk being tarred and feathered and run out of the conference on a rail?
Interesting concept. I've contacted several of the people that are going to be speakers, and three of them have gotten back to me so far, and they seem, at first, they seem really into the things I wanted to tell them. Then I sent a link to one of the videos we're going to play, and all of a sudden,
we may have a one
down
of these
with me.
Yeah,
and you know, record our interview, which is really interesting. It's really funny how people will say, "I'll follow the evidence anywhere." Yeah,
right.
unless it's something that's going to screw up your public persona,
yeah,
or whatever.
Unless it's something they really, really, really don't want to believe.
Yeah, unless it's something they really, really don't want to believe.
Yeah.
Now, it's like what I was going to say about your book. It's such a perfect title because the title says everything about Apollo. Apollo is really the biggest lie that's ever been three, philosophically, the biggest lie that mankind has ever told itself. I mean, yeah, the Holocaust, 9/11 killed people, and this only killed a few people.
Yeah.
But it's the biggest, in terms of man's, universe and all that, it's the biggest lie ever told, right? Wouldn't you say? I mean, you agree with that, right?
The title was, because in the series, it was supposed to be the second following the first, which I hope to have published tomorrow, which is entitled Nobody Died at Sandy Hook. So they respond to hearing nobody died at Sandy Hook by saying, oh, and I suppose we didn't go to the moon either.
Right. Well, that's what I'm saying. With all the people that believe in conspiracies, even, you know, that are awake, let's use that term, there are still so many of them that don't want to go near Apollo. And it's really a mind control thing that was so successful by the U.S. government. I mean, people that, you know, are on Red Ice Radio and on your show, if you brought up, you know, I'm listening to Red Ice Radio recently, and this guy, Mike Bass, is partner of Richard Hoagland. You know Richard Hoagland, right?
Yeah.
Who he is?
Yeah.
Or not? Yeah.
Well
he's supposed to be on.
Alan, but, you know, just where he comes down on these things is obscure to me. I'm not, I've not been into his work.
Right. Right. Well, here's the point. The point about Richard Hoagland is he's supposed to be a NASA maverick, you know, who's turned on his former employees, because he used to work for NASA, and has turned on them and is now exposing their lies. But to him, the lie about Apollo is not that we didn't go. He is rabid that Apollo was genuine, and what he says is that they're faking all the photos and stuff because of the sky, of the glass skyscrapers in the sky in the background and all the bases that they're lying about, right?
Let me just give you an observation of a guy who was in TV around the time of the Apollo landings, who observed that it would have taken a vehicle the size of a bread truck to put together everything you needed to do a broadcast. And yet they were broadcasting from the moon with no vehicle the size of a bread truck. In other words, they didn't even have the hardware it would have taken to broadcast from the moon, Alan. I mean, is that
No, Jim, Jim, let me make a different kind of point here. He's what I'm saying about Hoagland and a lot of other people, unfortunately, is if you think about it, what he's doing by saying NASA's lying, but they're lying about the moon bases, is a classic misdirection.
Yes.
What I'm saying, it to me, it's fairly obvious, not 100%, that he's working for the government.
Yes.
And
he never really left NASA. He's simply there in a different guise, in a different role.
He's saying they're lying, but what he's saying they're lying about is misdirection for the real lie that they never want. That happens all the time.
Now,
about 90% of us are government agents.
What I know about our conversations is they can be interminable. So since we have only like 50 more minutes, I know you have video clips you want to show and discuss. Yeah. So we may want to begin with one of them. Yeah.
Let's do one, because what I'm saying about, and this is how it connects to your book, and it's really a good book. I loved your preface, too. But what's interesting about what I'm trying to say here is it connects to Apollo directly, because what I've come to the conclusion of is the lies have not stopped at all. I mean, they faked Apollo. A rhetorical question. Why would they start doing anything real? Okay, including the International Space Station. Now, I'm going to bring up stuff here. Chance, if you want to start, let's play one, and then we'll talk about it. Play Why Are the Astronauts Still Lying? Can you do that? Okay.
Now, these aren't videos, so we'll see them when the broadcast is put up. Yeah.
No. That's just play that one. Lying astronauts. Why are the astronauts still lying? The still is important. No. Not the lying astronauts addendum. It's why are the astronauts still lying? Oh, no, don't say that. It's number 8. Oh, boy. All right. Yeah, sure.
You got me?
Are you there?
Yeah.
You definitely don't have it? All right, play the lying astronauts addendum. Let me explain what the other one was. The important stuff on it was I show 11 astronauts going back, starting with Neil Armstrong and Collins and Aldrin, saying that they can't see stars from the moon or from cislunar space. In other words, if they look out there, capsule window on the way to the moon, they couldn't see stars. I have 11, I forget if it's 11 or 12 different astronauts saying this, including 4 astronauts from the shuttle and the ISS. Okay. Now, you have to understand that, really pound this into your head. Pretend that you've seen 11 astronauts going from 1969 to like 6 months ago, all of them saying you cannot see stars when you're in low Earth orbit or on the moon or as soon as you leave the atmosphere, you can't see the stars. Okay, now play the lying astronauts addendum are some of the older astronauts repeating now the same thing, and then I have a clip from the right stuff, and then we'll talk.
Sky, of course, was black, but it had sort of a velvet sheen to it because of the light maybe that was coming in our visor.
The biggest visual surprise was just how black the sky was. You have a brilliant sun, brighter than any sun you normally would see even here in New Mexico. You have these extraordinarily high mountains. We were in a valley deeper than the Grand Canyon. But then you have this black sky, a sky blacker than black, as the old Viticon expression used to be.
I've often tried to explain the difference between darkness, when you turn out the lights and it's dark in here, or blackness. Blackness is the endlessness of it all. It's hard to comprehend.
Alan, tell us.
All right, you were able to watch it too, Jim, right?
No, actually, I won't see it until we actually play the show, Alan, so you'll have to talk about it.
Okay, we just saw the Lying Astronaut's addendum, right, Chance? The addendum, okay. So what that was, Jim, was four of the Apollo astronauts, I think it was four, three or four, recently, like in the last 10 years, claiming that space is flat black when you're in space. In other words, you can't see stars, you can see the sun and the earth, but everything else is flat black. Can't see anything. Then I played, a clip from the movie The Right Stuff, and this isn't proof, it's just a way of demonstrating what I'm talking about. Now, what happens in this clip, it's Chuck Yeager flying a test jet straight up. And as he goes straight up to 100,000 feet and the plane stalls and he ends up crashing, but that's not the point. When he gets to like 104,000 feet and it's during daytime, he looks out at his cockpit and he sees stars, right? Because he's above the atmosphere and that makes sense. Now that's not proof because it's a movie. But that is, in fact, what would happen, you know, in spite of the fact
that... Well, the difference being that Chuck Yeager is not a shill for the government. He's not a paid liar.
No, but it's the movie, though. I have, by coincidence, the producer of the movie, Bob Chartoff, was a good movie. As a friend of mine, he died a couple of years ago. He produced The Right Stuff, Rocky, Raging Bull, won several Academy Awards. He's a friend of mine. He produced the movie I wrote. I guess I'm just blowing my own horn. But, you know, I used to be a Hollywood sort of, not insider, but, you know, I made a good living in Hollywood. I'm not sure what the point of that is. But anyway, the point being...
You know the industry, Alan.
I know the industry. And, Bob, this is an older movie. He was not told to fake anything. Like I just saw two recent space movies, Interstellar and Gravity. You see either of them, Jim?
Interstellar and Gravity. Yeah, I saw Gravity. Wasn't that with Sandra Bullock?
Yes. Okay. Now, both of those movies, when they're in space and you look behind them, there are no stars. It's dead black, right? Just like the astronauts are saying.
So they're perpetuating the myth for the sake of
perpetuating the myth. Lie. It's a perfect example of Hollywood cooperation.
When I was a kid out in La Habra Heights, which was, you know, a bit in the outdoors in Southern California, my stepfather and I and my brother used to lie on the asphalt sidewalk, which was at a considerable angle, and he'd go through all the constellations. Right. And, I mean, the sky was ablaze with stars. I mean, why anyone would think you can see stars from Earth with all of its atmosphere, you wouldn't see stars even more clearly from an atmosphere-less moon, for example, is just ridiculous.
Well, that's really my point. My point is not just that it's a lie, but it's a lie that's so transparent that it's ridiculous. Now, the other
I don't think we need 9 minutes of the astronaut saying they couldn't see the stars, Alan. I think you've already dispatched them. You have so many other good clips. Let's go to some of them.
Okay, well, wait a minute. Let's finish up with the point I'm trying to make here, because it's important for my second thing that
sure.
I want to talk about, which is related.
Sure.
And that is, it's not just that they're lying. It's they're lying about something. It's a real Emperor's New Clothes kind of lie. And like, I've got the other video that we're not going to play, and you're right, in 9 minutes, the point is made. All these astronauts from 50 years ago till right now are claiming you can't see stars when you're in space. And some people make a deal out of it on their moon hoax things. But what I'm saying is it connects to today, and it's a very, very important issue because of the transparency of it and because of the continuation of the lies. In other words, they faked Apollo. We know that. What I'm saying is, you know, you probably have you ever thought of the thought that the space station and the shuttle might in some ways be faked?
I've heard that proposed before. I've never really had reason to doubt the existence of the space station, but Alan, you may have good reasons that would convince me.
Yeah, I think I do. I'm just an example is the fact that my little video it's got 24,000 hits, which is not a huge amount, but it's a good amount. But it's got over 700 comments, right? Well,
that's
lot of comments.
That's excellent. That suggests you have many more than 24,000 hits, Alan.
Yeah, I know YouTube lies about that. But my point being, if you look at the comments, you can see that probably 80% of them are shills, you know, they're paid to confuse.
Yeah, them. I think the government has quite a few on their payroll.
Oh, many, many. But my point here is that I touched a nerve.
Yeah, you touched a nerve, Alan, and I hope we have your voice restored here momentarily. Keep going.
Anyway, can you hear me now?
Yes, I can hear you now.
Yeah, but my point is that I've touched nerve on it, and the nerve is the Apollo hoax, you know, exposing that is one thing, but going up to, you know, saying that the International Space Station, there may be something circling around up there, but there are not people in it. You know, I don't believe that anymore. And it's taken me a lot of looking into it to come to this conclusion. That's really, if you think about it, that's pretty staggering. That they're still lying about faking space imagery. I mean, don't you agree that this is, you know, this
yeah,
is again,
yeah.
It's a continuation
it's
of the biggest lie.
One lie spins off another, Alan. It's an endless escalate of lies coming from our government.
Well, let's think about what the possibilities are as to why they would be faking it. One of them is what I said, which is they're flying around with a secret space program machines that they back engineered from UFOs or that they developed from Nazis or whatever. However they did it, there's anti-grav stuff, physics that the mainstream won't talk about. If they've been doing that for 20 years, it makes no sense for them to actually have a real Mickey Mouse space program. It would cost millions of dollars to fake it, whereas to really do it costs hundreds of billions. So they're going to save all that money. They're not going to risk having the space station blow up, get hit. It could be hit with a meteorite any time, and it would be a catastrophe. I mean, that's, you know, obvious. That's one possibility. And do you understand that one?
Yes, sir.
What?
Yes.
Okay. The second possibility is this. Right from the word go, they found out that man cannot be in space. You know, in other words, when they sent the first few astronauts up there, they found out that because of no gravity or because of radiation or because of stray meteorites or a combination of all of them, that it's not, that man ain't going anywhere. Okay? What if they found that out back in 1961? What would they do? They, for whatever reason, being Souliard, when they're very different. Do you understand what I mean?
Yep.
Okay, those are the two possibilities. I don't know which one it is. Okay, you know what? Since we're on the subject of NASA faking stuff, let's put on the Mars stuff one. It's short. It's very rough. I have to apologize. I just screen grabbed it, so it's a little bit jagged, but it's not long. Can you put that on now, Chance?
So you don't have liquid water, and of course, because the temperature is very cold, but no.
Welcome to Rich Planet TV. On last week's show, we presented the Mars Rover Hypothesis, in which I suggested that the Mars rovers, which according to NASA, landed on Mars and are sending back images of Mars, could in fact be at remote locations on the Earth as part of a well-organized deception. We examined photographs produced by NASA, allegedly taken from the Martian surface, which appear to show objects commonly found on the Earth. Starting with a small rodent identified possibly as an Arctic lemming, a lump of wood possibly from an old railway sleeper, the vertebra of a large sea creature, a bone identified possibly as a walrus arm bone, lichen growing on rocks, a crinoid fossil, and also photographs which prove NASA have falsified the colours in many of their images. The question which arises is, do these anomalies provide evidence that all the images from the Mars rovers are in fact being taken from remote locations on the Earth?
Okay, Jim. Jim, what that was a video of NASA's photographs. They're all NASA's. And incredibly, and believe me, I had to shake my head and look again, they show stuff on the Martian surface, like, you know, and it's not obvious. You have to crop it and look at it. There's a backbone of like a whale, you know, like some kind of
on the surface of Mars. They're claiming there's the backbone of a whale.
Right.
Alan, that's ridiculous. Imagine how much evolution would have had to go through on Mars to get to a whale. I mean, it's ridiculous. They'd be better off shipping it up bone by bone.
Thousands of pictures, and they didn't notice it. You understand?
And they didn't notice it.
Yeah. So what that Rich Hall is saying, and I completely agree with him, and he's done, and you gotta, if you're interested in the subject, look at his whole video, because that was only just a little chunk of it. He has like five photographs that you look at, and there's a bone, another kind of bone, there's lichens, there's a railroad, cross strut. It's just absolutely ridiculous. And he's looked into where they claim that they did their practicing for the Mars thing with the rovers, and it's up in Canada somewhere. And he's shown, and they also faked the color in the photographs. What he's showing is that NASA did not go to Mars.
Yeah. That they even faked their Mars footage, which is no surprise given they fake going to the moon. Mars is overwhelmingly
more. They're faking that. And it ties in completely to the Apollo fakery. You know, I mean, I'm preaching to the choir here to a certain extent, because you know the extent they went to make us think that they went to the moon. Why would they not do that with Mars too? Why, if they have a secret space program and they can go to Mars in a anti-grav device, why would they spend the money and take the chances to really do it when they can fake it for the price of a feature film, which is all it takes?
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is everything that we look at with NASA is funneling us to the inescapable conclusion that they did not stop lying after Apollo. It doesn't make any sense that they'd suddenly be honest and tell us the truth about what they're doing.
Right.
You know, I think, to me, this is profound shit, because it does go to what man can do, or what. See, I don't know whether let's assume that they have gone to Mars in their secret space program. They would find, you know, they already know what the soil is like in Mars. They went there in like 1960 or whatever. And so if they want to tell us some stuff about Mars, you know, what the soil is like or whatever, they can tell us the truth or they can lie, whatever they want to do. But they already have the information. You know what I mean? They already know this stuff. And I think that's the case for certain other reasons, that they already...
They're also very used to lying now. And why change now?
Well, they're like spies. That's their job. You know what I mean? That's it, period. But we got to watch out for the shills. I think Hoagland and his... I'll tell you, give me an example of what Hoagland... You know, with his moon and his Mars book, Dark Mission, he claims, and I heard Mike Barra say it on Red Ice Radio, and he says on his website that NASA had special film that they used for the Hasselblad shots, special film that you can't take a bad picture with.
You're kidding me.
No. He said
it's film. Yeah, it focuses itself, doesn't it, Alan?
Yeah, absolutely.
It focuses, frames itself, makes sure everything is exactly right. How absurd can you get?
You're making my point for me very good. You're not even a photographer.
Stupid beyond belief, Alan.
You're not even a photographer, and you understand how
stupid beyond belief.
It's another example of when the lie is so transparently ridiculous. Then you got to really sort of start wondering. Now, what this tells me is people out there that think Richard C. Hoagland, with his white hair and his attitude, is some kind of great guy that's telling us the truth. If he would lie about having a special film that can't take a bad picture, I mean, there's no limit. You know, and this is part of the lie to support his contention that you and I are idiots for being hoaxers, and we went to the moon with Apollo. So, I mean, we're surrounded by you know, people that are actually working for the other side.
Ellen, I know you have a lot of clips, so I want to encourage you to.
I guess I made my point with.
You have about the Mars and the Moon and Apollo and the shells and the faking it.
Right. Now I want to get even heavier. In my opinion, this is even more Emperor's New Clothes and really, really shocking stuff. You believe in science. You're the perfect guy for me to talk about this because you're a philosopher of science and this is your thing. But I believe, I'm going to show you some people that are very smart people that I met at the Electric Universe conference. And what I'm going to be saying here is that the people that are theoretical physicists, in cosmology and physics, are the queen of the sciences. They're, you know, that's the base of science is physics. I'm coming to the conclusion that these people are either all useful idiots or all working for the other side. And I'll tell you why. Let me ask you this. How do you feel about the Big Bang?
The Big Bang is overwhelmingly more plausible than the steady state universe model. But Alan, which Big Bang? You could have a Big Bang expansion, reach a limit contraction, a big crunch, and then another Big Bang expansion, reach a limit contraction, big crunch. So, Big Bang doesn't determine in which cycle or which, episode of an potentially endless series of Big Bangs we could be in.
But what they call the hot Big Bang is now part of the popular culture. It's now seen not as a theory, but as a fact. They talk about the Big Bang as if that's it. It's a fact, right?
Well, I think the redshift and a host of other forms of evidence suggests that there's expansion of the universe taking place. It's consistent with the Big Bang and not with a constant.
Okay, I'm going to show you that you've been misled. Chance, let's start with Halton Arp and the redshift. Can you play that?
He was an outstanding student of Edwin Hubble. Without qualification, he is the modern equivalent of a Kepler or Galileo. He has empirically shown that the Big Bang theory of an expanding universe is nonsense. Faint objects are intrinsically redshifted. Arp produced the standard reference works on peculiar galaxies, and while compiling these works, he's noticed a significant clustering of faint, highly redshifted objects known as quasars near galaxies with low redshift and unusual activity in their cores. But this confronted astronomers' beliefs, so like Galileo, he was forced to desist from pursuing his research. His telescope time was withdrawn, despite the fact that he was a leading astronomer up to that point, and he left the USA for Germany, where room was made for him at the Max Planck Institute. The universe did not begin with a bang. He found the redshift is mainly a measure of the youthfulness of an object, and this comes into the energy levels of the matter within the object. Yes, he found these quantum redshift effects on a galactic scale. But this confronted astronomers' beliefs, so like Galileo, he was forced to desist from pursuing his research. His telescope time was withdrawn, despite the fact that he was a leading astronomer up to that point, and he left the USA for Germany, where room was made for him at the Max Planck Institute.
Okay. You heard enough of that to at least get the drift, right?
Yeah, but I don't know who's right and who's wrong here, Alan. Well, I mean, physics is shifting, new developments in physics occur all the time. So I'm not.
I understand. I understand.
That wasn't Andrew Johnson, was it?
No. That was Walt Thornhill of the Electric Universe. No, he's a physicist.
Okay.
I was talking, but here's the thing. Just take my word for it for now that you have to look into this, because I really have looked into it.
Well, I had a show on the Electric Universe that was really well received, Alan. You might want to check it out. I may be ahead of you on this.
But you're not going to take my word for that. I understand. You have to look into it. Let's play. Now, what I'm going to show you next is about a minute, a little over that, of a Nobel Prize winning physicist. who was going to, now this is where you come in, because he's going to say some things, and I want you, you can't see it, but you listen to it carefully. He's going to say some things that by pure logic, and you being a card carrying, critical thinker, are going to have to deal with what he's saying. This guy's a Nobel Prize winning guy who, a cosmologist who, is part of the group behind the Big Bang. And just listen to how this goes. Somebody's going to play a chance, and we're going to cut it at about a minute and 15 seconds. I'll let you know. Yeah, science and nonsense.
Winning astrophysicist answering a question from an 11-year-old student on an Australian panel show called Q&A just last month.
Thanks, Tony. I have a question on science for my son Lachlan, actually. His question is for Brian Smith, because he's very interested in physics. He's starting high school next year. And his question is, how can something as infinitely large as the universe actually get bigger?
Ah! Yes, this is always a problem, infinity getting bigger. So if you think of the universe, and when we measure the universe, it, as near as we can tell, is very close to being infinite in size. So imagine you have an infinite universe, which I say is expanding. Infinity is just getting bigger, and we're allowed to do that in mathematics.
Peter, you made a point, I think, a quiet point to me while Brian was speaking.
Well, you know, I told you early on, physicists are the smartest people on Earth, and, you know, there you have it. So.
There you have it.
Okay, what do you think? First of all, he used the phrase, it's close to being infinite in size. As a philosopher of science, what do you think of the idea of something being almost infinite?
Well, Alan, there are several issues here. Generally, when they talk about, you know, the universe as being unbounded, meaning it has no specific limits, and something that has
infinite size.
I'm making a different point, Alan. I'm putting this in a framework, all right? Which is to say, generally, the universe is understood to be unbounded, very, very large, unbounded, potentially expanding endlessly. Now, if you would say that we had the universe at one time that was unbounded, but of certain dimensions, nevertheless, it could become larger and have larger dimensions and be unbounded, and that might be the way in which they mean to be using the term. Infinite means an unending series. It has no last term. Or if you were interpolating, there'd be no final measurement of a smallness of something, as in the Zeno paradoxes. But that, you know, for me to be able to appreciate what's going on here, I would need to know more about the context of the exchange.
Yeah, let me just say this. So unbounded only means you don't run into a wall. It means that space is curved, that you'll come back to the place you started if you go in a straight line. Long enough. What he's saying,
there are a lot of concepts in physics that are difficult to wrap your mind around, Alan, especially if we take them, you know, out of context and so forth. But I'm interested in your views on this, and not whether, you know, I necessarily agree with your interpretations. I'm very glad to have you here to be talking about things that have struck you as odd or anomalous or strange.
Okay. To me, it was interesting because it was an 11-year-old kid, really, who asked the question. And to me, it's like the kid in the Emperor's New Clothes. I'm sorry. If something's infinite, that means of size that's unlimited. What I would ask this Nobel Prize winner, I would say, give me a number that's almost infinite. And if he gave me a number, I then multiply it by, say, 1,000 billion.
Alan, we
say, is your number still infinite?
We understand the anomalies associated here, yes.
Okay.
Let's go to talking, yes.
Let's go to a heavier refutation of a guy that I've gotten friendly with named Steve Crothers. who's a mathematician and astronomer. I think let's play, Chance, let's play Steve Crothers on Hawking.
This is from a book on astrophysics by Carolyn Ostley. A non-rotating black hole has a particularly simple structure. At the center is a singularity, a point of zero volume. Yeah, we divided by zero according to their rules. And infinite density, where all the black hole's mass is located. Space-time is infinitely curved at the singularity. The black hole singularity is a real physical entity. It is not a mathematical artifact. So they're dividing by naught. Here again, this is from Dodson and Poston, a book on tensor geometry. Once a body of mass of any mass of matter of any mass m lies inside its Schwarzschild radius, that's the event, the so-called radius of the event horizon, it undergoes gravitational collapse and the singularity becomes physical, not a limiting fiction. So it's not elementary calculus where you take a limit. No, you actually divide by naught. Well, that's nonsense. Here is, the universe comes from nothing. Hawking tells us, at the Big Bang itself, the universe is thought to have had zero size and to have been infinitely hot. Let's think about that. It's zero size, but it has infinite hotness. What is there to have infinite hotness? And what is temperature? According to physicists, temperature is all these particles jiggling around. And the more they jiggle, the hotter it is. You put more energy, whatever that is, into it, and it jiggles and jiggles more. This is hotter. Well, if you've got zero size, how do you have space for particles? And where do they jiggle? And if it's infinitely hot, how fast are they jiggling? I don't think Hawking's thinking very clearly when he says this. Here, zero size and infinite hotness. This is a meaningless statement.
Stephen Hawking! The world's smartest man!
What are you doing here?
Hello.
Hello, it's Stephen.
Oh, hi, Stephen Hawking. I can't believe it.
Wow, that's amazing.
Well, thank you.
I just wanted
to call you to tell you how happy I am that you're excited about the new electronic universe theory.
It's amazing.
But don't bother trying to explain it to them. Their pea brains cannot grasp the idea of the world on the brain.
Yeah, I know.
Their pea brains cannot grasp the idea of the world on the brain.
Yeah, I know.
All right. That was Steve Crothers. It really would be better if you could see him and stuff, but I'm sorry, you can't have a point infinitely small and of infinite temperature. It's just common sense. And if
that's the problem, Alan. It isn't. What they're talking about isn't common sense. They're talking about all the mass and energy in the universe concentrated into a very tiny, tiny volume. It's not actually zero. It might as well be zero. It's one of those anomalies about using mathematics in a sense of pure mathematics as an idealization and talking about physical quantities and comparing them to the mathematical idealization, even though they don't have an exact fit. Now, you're right to say they don't have an exact fit. That is correct. But you're wrong to say that it's therefore incoherent. That's simply misunderstanding the relationship between the mathematical idealization and the physical reality that is being described as the core of the Big Bang here.
Well, I just disagree with you because I've looked into it for the last few months. I've really been concentrating on this.
In my opinion, and this happened before, I don't think you've ever appreciated the difference between pure mathematics and applied mathematics. There's a big difference. The context of pure mathematics is talking about abstract structures that have no specific physical correlates. In applied mathematics, you're using numbers to designate physical entities and that requires physical metrics in order to be applied. It's a deep philosophical issue, and I'm not going to insult you by saying I just don't think you have it right. I'm just saying I don't think you have it right. That's all.
Well, it's not me. It's just that I'm seeing the work of other people and realizing that they have to be right. For example, as Crothers shows, they have equations where they divide by zero. And I'm sorry, just because you're a Nobel Prize winner, you can't divide by zero.
Well, this is interesting because it was a conversation between the Meyer Lansky and Chauncey Marvin Holt, where Meyer made Chauncey his accountant, where Meyer organized the modern Cosa Nostra, so that Chauncey was in this extraordinarily sensitive position of being the accountant to the head of the mafia in the United States. And what led to his inviting is when Meyer referred to division by zero and said, of course, well, division by zero always yields nothing. And Chauncey corrected him and said, no, division by zero equals infinity because there are infinitely many nothings in something. Meyer was sufficiently impressed that he made Chauncey his account.
Well, I'm not sure what that has to do with physics. But the point
is, how many nothings are there in something? And the answer would be infinitely many. You were surely going to suggest that division by zero equals zero, which was Meyer Lansky's own thought at the time. But you see, I think you can appreciate the point that Chauncey was making. Let's do another one of your clips, Alan. I know you got a lot of great stuff here you want to bring out.
Okay. 4 minutes left for the whole show.
Well, we'll squeeze another one in, even if we have to go over
a
couple minutes.
Play the Steve Crothers interview, because he just explains what he shows in his presentations. It's only a minute and something.
There are almost daily reports that black holes have been found. Has anybody actually found a black hole?
The answer to that is no. No one has ever found a black hole. There are two characteristics that are alleged for these black holes, and one is an event horizon and a singularity, and no one has ever found either one of them. And the other thing is that the true definition of black hole universe is that it contains only one mass, and that's the black hole itself. So you can't have multiple black holes. So consequently, no one can say that there are black holes all over the universe. And so they can't find any because there's nothing to find.
You say that there are different types of black hole universes and Big Bang universes, and they can't coexist. What does that mean?
Well, there are. There are four different types of black holes that have been alleged in theory. And I can list them for you quickly. It's a non-rotating charge neutral, non-rotating charged, rotating charge neutral, and rotating charged. So there are four types. Sizes don't matter. And then there are three types of Big Bangs. One is a spatially finite universe that's expanding, and the other two are spatially infinite universes of different characteristics, and they're expanding. And so by their very definitions, they can't coexist because, let's take for example, black hole universes are all eternal, but all Big Bang universes are of a finite age. Black hole universes are spatially infinite, but we have the three black hole, Big Bang universes. One is finite and two are infinite in a different characteristic. So they can't coexist by definition.
Alan, go for it.
Yeah, what I'm going to say here, again, is a logical thing. You don't have to know anything about math. But what he's saying there, basically, sort of cutting to the chase and simplifying, is that the Big Bang theorists all say that a Big Bang, because of the equations, exists in universes of infinite age, in other words, of infinite age. And all of the Big Bang, I just said black holes, right? Black holes exist in universes of infinite age. And every Big Bang universe, of course, is of finite age because it had to start with the Big Bang and then continue on. So it's a finite age. So what I'm saying here is this is where it's the emperor's new clothes. By definition, you cannot have a black hole, period, because none of the universes that they postulate are of infinite age. Now, that's logic. That's not anything where you can say, well, Alan, you don't know math well enough or whatever. That's period. And if that's true, just give me this. If what I said is just true, if Steve Crothers shows that by their definition, black holes cannot exist, if that's true, just give me that for a hypothetical, then we know something is very wrong with the whole Big Bang black hole. Expanding space is the real problem, because Halt and Arp showed that space is not expanding. That's made up, and he was excommunicated from physics because he showed that. That's where they're at with physics.
Well,
if you show that they're wrong, they throw you out.
Jim, just a quick point.
Yeah.
Is there any way, I just wanted to send Alan maybe after the show a sacred geometry shape that puts an infinite into a finite space. So it's possible, if you start studying sacred geometry, you find infinite mass in a finite space, and I'll send you a graphic of it after the show.
Well, Alan's certainly inspiring me to look into
the state of current geometry.
Alan, I want to thank you for coming on with some of these anomalies and brain teasers. You're excellent at that. Yeah. And I look forward to having you back, my friend. And in the meanwhile, we'll get water time up.
Great. Send them to my website. They can join my blog at banditobooks.com.
Banditobooks.com. Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, thanking my special guest the first hour, Alan Weisbecker, the author of the cult classic, The Search for Captain Zero. Bandito, Bandits, and Water Time, to which we shall return soon. Thank you for being here, Alan. Stand by for the new JFK show with Kerry King, Donald Fox, Larry Rivera, and more. We'll be
We can
right
now
back.
Say, with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority, that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll get new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22nd, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
Less than 3% of you people read books, because less than 15% of you read newspapers. Right now, there is a whole, an entire generation that never knew anything that didn't come out of this tube. This tube can make or break presidents, popes, prime ministers. Television is not the truth. Television is a circus, a carnival, a traveling troupe of acrobats, storytellers, dancers, singers, jugglers, sideshow freaks, lion tamers, and football players. We deal in illusions, man. None of it is true. But you people sit there day after day, night after night, all ages, colors, creeds.
Broadcasting live on network radio.
So turn off your television sets. Turn them off now. Turn them off and leave them off.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
We're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
Welcome to the Opt-Out Show. This is the new JFK show number 78.
God damn.
All right. We've got some serious issues, man. Might as well get right to it. All right. I was in an unusual situation this weekend, and the reason wearing my coonskin hat is we're opt-hunting tonight. We're out on the hunt. So let's see how many we can bag tonight. All right. So I was in a very unusual situation because I know Chris Milligan really well. I know Lorian Fenton, who I'll actually be on her show tonight to promote my radio network, Firehorse Radio Network. All right, but the situation is that, of course, I'm a musician, and I like to help out as much as I can. And I volunteered to do sound for this conference probably about 6 months ago before they even knew if they were going to have it or not. So I ended up being a sound man and the audio guy. So anytime the microphone was messing up, if they were too far from the mic, whatever it is, I had to run up and fix it. In fact, Joan Mellon was talking and she started to fall down. So we had to move a chair over and let her sit down and I had to fix the mic. Typical roadie stuff, sound man type things. However, I don't think anybody knew that I did a weekly show with Dr. James Fetzer, Larry Vera, Don Fox. They just thought I was the sound dude.
I love it. I love it, Gary.
All right, so I was forced.
Does that make you a covert agent?
Well, I will say I was not. I did not do anything. I didn't plant anybody in the audience to say anything. I literally was at work, and I was 12 hours a day. And it was a real job. Let me tell you what, you know, the next speaker, the Skype connection will, won't work. You know how it was in Santa Barbara there, Dr. Fetzer? You know, you remember that?
Yeah, sure. I do.
All right. Well, it wasn't an easy job, but I pulled it off. So regardless of how much of an op they were or how much of a truth teller they were, I had to hook their butts up and let them talk. So here's the situation. I've been to quite a few conferences, but I've never sat through the conference from the beginning to the end, 3 days worth, 12 hours a day, because I had to and I was getting paid. So
I like that. I like that getting paid part, Gary.
Yeah, that's the only way you could have got me to sit through Robert Groden. I'll tell you that. All right. So I just have to say, I'll just save it for later. All right, so you guys wanted to go over the conference and kind of talk over each one and let me give my insights?
Yeah. We can begin in the beginning. Tell us about the overall structure of the conference. How was it set up?
Well, first of all, we had made an historic discovery a few days later, and Larry had asked me to bring this new information to the attention of quite a few researchers out there, and we know what it is. It's the overlay. It's a brand new thing. If you don't know about it, you can find it on Chance's site, on my site, 100% proof of Oswald in the doorway. So I came packing, bearing gifts. So I had my little Mac Mini in one hand, and I had my little stick over here, and I went to Ed Tatro. I said, Ed, Larry has something he wants you to see. And he said, I saw it already. It's a 50-year-old thing. Man, there's no proof of that. This is old.
50-year-old thing?
That's what he told me. Right. He said, it's a bunch of stuff. I said, but wait a minute, Mr. Ed. I said, you just gave a speech about Ed, Jim Garrison for an hour and a half. Jim Garrison says on camera that it was Lee in the house, Lee in the doorway. I said Harold Weisberg said the same thing. Beverly Brunson, Shirley Martin, Penn Jones, and he said, and I can recognize a fallacy thanks to you, Dr. Fetzer. He said, I knew all of those guys personally. I said, but wait. Are you saying Jim Garrison didn't know what he was talking about? And I said, well, wait, what about Will Fritz's notes that was found in 1993? Does that mean nothing? And he scoffed. So I'm here to say, for the most part, Larry's work was scoffed at, not welcome, unimportant, and 50-year-old hogwash.
Gary, let me ask you this. If I were organizing this conference, I might have had a segment on Zapruder film authenticity, proving the limo stop, the riders, and all that, that the film had been massively edited. I would have had another segment on Oswald in the doorway going through the mountain of evidence. I would have another segment on the shooting teams, including the Dell Techs, where George Herbert Walker Bush was supervising Nestor Tony Escadro firing three shots with a Mannlicher Carcano. I would have organized it topically like that. How was this conference organized?
Okay, now you can forget it about the Zapruder film alteration, and you can forget it about Annie Lee in the doorway. Now these ladies, Sarah Peterson and Katana Zachary, they went on about Oswald in the doorway, but to be honest with you, I was paying attention, I thought, and I don't know what they said really, but the closest you got to any Bush, George Bush stuff was Russ Baker. Now, you remember last year, right, Dr. Fetzer, with Russ Baker, we had the ride in the cab, and I tried to tell him about some Boston Marathon, and he said, he didn't know anything about it, and then we wrote an article. Well, there was Russ Baker again, and believe it or not, my band played at Oswald's birthday party. You can see it online. Type in Oswald's birthday party 2015. You can see GK ripping on guitar. But anyway, it was kind of strange because we were playing in the club and then we went outside and Russ Baker and Daniel Hopsicker came up to me and said, dude, your freaking band rocks, man. Yeah, I can't believe it, man. Y'all one of the best bands ever, you know? And I looked at him. I said, have you had enough time to look into the Boston Marathon? And then he jumped on me. So I don't think he really recognized me. And he said, we did 63 articles on that. Haven't you checked my website? And I said, yeah, it's pretty spooky there. I said, that's all mainstream articles. And I just looked at him and Hopsicker and I told them both. I said, if y'all don't say that the Boston Marathon was a complete hoax, I was looking him dead in the eye. We almost came to blows. I'm telling you, Hopsicker and me and Russ Baker, we were about to go at it in the parking lot.
Gary, it's ridiculous. This is the most blatant, most amateurish false flag attack in the history of the United States. We've had doozies.
But here's what happened. When I told him, I said, look, if y'all guys can't figure out the Boston Marathon was a complete hoax and all of your stories are mainstream junk, then you need to quit and go home. And then here's what Russ did. He said, oh, I see where this is going. And he put his hands in his pocket and he went back in the club.
He sees where this is going. Don, what's your take on what you're hearing here about this? It's kind of flooring, if you ask me.
Yeah, I've talked to Gary about this. We had a nice little conversation last night. And I told him, I missed the first couple minutes of the show, but you know, I was telling Gary last week when he told me he was going to be at this thing, and my first thought was, what the hell are you doing there, Gary? I wouldn't even show up for this thing. He's like, well,
he was making a few bucks. He was running the sound system. Well, his band was playing.
Yeah.
He was soaking it in, right and left, soaking it in.
After we played Secret Agent Man with St. John Hunt, think about that. I'm playing with Chris Milligan. He's wailing on the harmonica. St. John Hunt, whose dad has got to be one of the biggest spooks of all time. And what song do we play? Secret Agent Man.
Of course. That had to be a highlight. That had to be a highlight of the whole conference.
All right, so imagine this. We're in a club called the River Shack, which is a really, really famous club from way back. Lee and I used to go there. But the place is hopping. It's packed. There's people everywhere. And there have never been more spooks assembled in one room in a long time. All right, so I got all these people. We got Russ Baker. We got Roger Stone. We got Ed Haslam, who is a truth teller. And over here we got Hopsicker. You know, just all these ops all over the place.
Well, Roger, what was Roger addressing, Gary? I'm interviewing him tomorrow about his new book on the Clinton's War on Women, but he published an earlier book about LBJ being responsible for the death of JFK. So he seems to me to be a good man. Mm-hmm.
Well, we've got our tentacles up on Stone, okay? We don't have 100% definitive here, but all I can say is, this may mean nothing, but if you are a former writer for the New York Times, Washington Post, blah, 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 you ain't fooling me anymore. But anyway, I'm going to leave that one up to you, okay? What I believe, and Don and I talked about this, that there are these people like Baker, Hopsicker, and the one you're talking about who have written for the mainstream guys. But suddenly we're told that they wrote a bad article and now they've been extracised from news, see? And now they're out there doing good reporting. That's a bunch of baloney. They're limited hangouts.
Gary, was there an organizational principle to this conference? I mean, I was talking about, you know, you might have had one about LBJ and who was responsible for the assassin. What about the shooters and where they were located? What about the doorman? What about the limousine? You didn't have anything like that?
The doorman was banned.
That's exactly what I told Gary this week. I said, hey, look, Gary. But before he told me he was doing this thing, I says, well, hey, look, we were talking about Oswald and Larry Rivera and Ralph Sinquet and all their work. And I said, look, the one thing that they just can't have is Oswald in the doorway. Okay. There can be debates over the single bullet theory. That's fine. You know, you can debate, Jack.
Did he go to Mexico?
Did he go to Mexico? Yeah, that's fine. You can talk about that stuff, but Oswald in the doorway.
I felt like it was a gong show.
But this is the most important development of recent times in JFK research. That and Larry's work on the Newcomer interviews. These are the two major developments of the last 5 years, for God's sake.
Not at this conference.
We have a conference in 2015 that doesn't address them.
Okay. I'm not here. The Z film was not allowed. I'm not saying not allowed, but there wasn't anyone talking about it. And I did say to Chris, I said, look, man, why don't you let me show this at the end? He said, no. None of the Oswald. And he said, it's not Oswald in the doorway. Forget about it. We're not going there.
But, you know, I've heard that when Judith was shown, she said, of course. She said she'd already proven he was in the doorway.
I talked to him about that. I said, Chris, Judy wrote an article. He says, well, it doesn't mean that I agree with everything Judy does.
Is he now the expert rather than Judith? Is Chris Mulligan now claiming he's the expert on JFK rather than Judith?
We're only talking about Oswald in the doorway.
No, Jim, isn't Chris Mulligan on the OIC page? I thought he was on the OIC page. What's going on there?
He is on the OIC page. That's a good question. He's already subscribed to the proposition.
Look, man, I was there. I asked him that. I'm not letting anybody get away with this.
So maybe as chairman, I need to look into that.
Yeah, I think he ought to look into that.
I'll tell you what he said. Here's what he said. I believe Oswald is innocent, but I don't think it's him in the doorway.
That doesn't qualify him for the OIC.
That's right.
And
here he got a former chair, me, and the present chair, Larry, and we're both agreeing that that doesn't mean he should be a member of the OIC if that's as far as it goes.
That's the number one mantra of the organization.
We have a statement that spells it out, that he's innocent because he was in the doorway.
That's right.
How ridiculous can you get?
That's right.
Yeah. All right, so let's go down the list, and then Larry's got some stuff at the end of the show. All right.
Yeah.
Chris Mulligan was the first speaker. He's pretty much the one that put it on. I believe Chris Mulligan is a truth teller. I also had a serious question for him. I said, how in the hell did you have Judy Baker at 9 a.m. and Joan Mellon at 10 a.m.? And I said, Dr. Fessner and I have done two radio shows defending Judith from Joan Mellon. And he said, I'm a peacemaker, Gary. He said, it was said that they would never appear in the same room. Well, here they are, back to back. I'm a peacemaker. So that's what he said. So I like Chris.
That doesn't cut it, Gary. That doesn't cut it. A peacemaker? Ridiculous. You got one woman who's trying to cut Judith's throat, and then you got Judith there? That doesn't work.
They were following each other.
That's something's very wrong there.
Right. Okay, so on to David Denton. I respect David Denton. He's a good, honest, straight-up researcher.
He is.
Okay, do you guys know David Denton?
I am not familiar with his work.
Mm-hmm. Well, he basically put on the conference last year, the good conference. So he was the one.
He went on a conference at a small college in Illinois. That's where Ed Tatro said he'd spoken to Marina about the shirt, and she remembered having washed Oswald's shirt, in which he was arrested, and which he was wearing in the doorway. That was significant, I thought, and very positive, big plus for Ed Tatro to be reporting that.
Mm-hmm. Except Ted doesn't buy Oswald in the doorway, though, does he?
No, not at all.
I don't know.
No, he scoffed at it. I talked to him personally. I looked him right in the eye. I said, come on, man. I said, look, your entire presentation was about Jim Garrison, but he didn't know what the hell he's talking about with Lee in the doorway. I said, look, man, you can see the button. You can see the safety pin. So I'm just telling you that these researchers, they seem to have looked under every single rock that there could ever be, but they ain't looking under this one. So that's how I see it.
I just wanted to ask you, Gary, how is it possible that all these people supposedly had already seen this research when it was only a couple of days old? You know, how do you figure that they got around to seeing this and automatically rejecting it when it was only a couple of days old? What did they have, like, a meeting or something? You know, I don't understand. Can you explain that?
I don't know, because I didn't show it to anyone. They had already seen it. So it's like we're in trouble. All right, so then we had Judy Baker up next. All right, so Dr. Fetzer, go ahead with Judy Baker.
Well, Judith has done some brilliant work. I mean, her article, which I entitled Judith Very Baker Cements Oswald in the Doorway, is a direct refutation of Robert Grodin's work for the HSCA, where Grodin was assigned the task of determining whether the man in the doorway was or was not Lee Oswald. And he claimed back, claiming he returned to them with a report claiming that the shirt, the pattern of the shirt Billy Lovelady was wearing, where he even got that wrong, because he's talking about the red and black checkered shirt, not the red and white vertically striped shirt Billy was actually wearing, in which the FBI photographed him on 29 February 1964. But the red and black checkered shirt, he said that was a closer match to the doorman shirt than was Lee Oswald's shirt. And Judith, by a much more sophisticated and scientifically impeccable study and comparison, demonstrated precisely the opposite to be true. And this leaves me wondering, Gary, why she can continue to feel fondness and affection for Robert Grodin. But he's been a principal player on the other side and deceiving the JFK community in that role. I mean, it's very stunning to me.
Right, right.
Very unusual. The whole thing was.
Well, Gary reported that the only person who actually accepted the overlay technology was Judith, saying that, you know, I knew that all along.
Well, so, I have to give Jim Mars a semi pass right now. I told Jim Mars about it. I said, the game is over. We're using this as our litmus test. I told him all that. I said, we're using this as our litmus test to who's real and who's not. I told Ed Tatro that. I told Jim Mars that. And at the very end, he actually said that there may be some new evidence leading to Oswald being in the doorway. So stay tuned. He said he hadn't seen it. And he said we all have to stay open to the idea that Oswald may be the one in the doorway. So it looks like we're going to have to bring Jim Mars kind of kicking and screaming through the door, huh?
That's kind of odd, isn't it? That's kind of odd that Jim, after all these years, would have any hesitation about it. I mean, he and I collaborated on an article demonstrating that the backyard photographs were fabrications and fakes, where you have this group at Dartmouth, of all places, where the FBI is funding a laboratory for this fellow, Hanny Farad, who is clearly in awe, publishing on the authenticity of the backyard photographs by focusing on just those elements that haven't been faked. He focused on the shadow under the nose in an earlier article, and now you have people who are saying, well, they aren't fake because a man actually could anatomically have the balance shown of the person in the photographs. But, you know, while he looks odd in the photographs, no one has ever claimed that that was proof that they were fabricated. We have a host of other evidence of that, including that Oswald's face is exactly the same through a whole series, that there's an insert line between the lower lip and the chin, that the chin is not Lee Oswald's chin, that the fingertips of the right hand are all cut off, that if you use the newspapers as an internal yardstick, you determine the individual in the photograph is too short to be Lee Oswald, which means either they used someone who was too short, or more likely when they created the photograph, they introduced the newspapers too large. Jack White established that. So I republished this article that Jim and I had originally published back in 2011.
Yeah, the bump on the forearm.
The bump on the forearm he'd noticed for Roscoe White.
That's right.
Roscoe's got the right chin, and he's got the right bump on the arm.
Well, we have some overlays that we applied the same technology that Chance has that maybe later on he can...
Play them now, Larry. We can play them now.
Let's go through all the people, and we'll speed it up, and then we'll go to that.
I think this is so significant, and it fits so well, Gary. We'll come back to the riffraff, because that's what you're talking about. The riffraff.
Okay, we'll do that, but we have a new name. We're the freaking JFK Posse.
The Posse, okay. Posse. Chance, have you got it so you can play it? Okay, why don't you go ahead and play it, Larry, and you can talk about it. Tell us what you have here.
Well, we have actually three items here to discuss briefly. The first one is a comparison of the New Orleans, of the two mugshots between the New Orleans PD and the Dallas PD. Obviously, the first, the New Orleans, from when he was arrested in that fracas with Carlos Bringier, and then compared with the Dallas Police Department photograph, the mugshot. And when we overlaid both of these, lo and behold, they are exactly...
We got some heavy breathing there, Chance, so I don't know what the deal is.
I think it's Gary. What happened to your head?
It's not me.
It's not me.
Okay, go ahead, Larry. Continue.
Anyway, the comparisons and the overlays between the NOPD and the DPD are exactly... I mean, within millimeters of each other, and as far as them being exactly the same image, which proves that the person that was arrested in New Orleans and the person that was arrested in Dallas were one and the same person. I mean,
excellent. That's very good all by itself, Larry.
That's right, because that is your control image. Now, when we go and we overlaid both of those independently over the the backyard photograph, I mean, it was just amazing the difference where the left side, which would be the right side of the head, protruded in such a way that we're talking about 2 to 3 inches, much larger. It was totally amorphous. And the chin, obviously, when we ran it all the way through, the chin, the cleft that Lee Oswald had there, was clearly visible, where the other one was a totally flat chin. And,
Larry, this is brilliant. You've developed a whole new methodology for testing propositions about identity of suspects.
And that's right.
Photos. This is absolutely sensational, Larry.
Yeah,
that's right. And since we're talking about that, I went in and obtained a lot of information and sources on face recognition and forensic science. And it's been completely accepted. It is a branch of forensic science that is already very mature, And the procedure of the comparison can be qualitative or quantitative, using relative or absolute dimensions. In morphological comparison, the location and size of facial features is measured relatively, not absolutely. If the perspectives of the questioned and known images are similar and the position of the head is similar, the image depicting the known individual can be scaled to that of the questioned individual by using interpupillary distance or other consistent features within the image, interpupillary being the eyes, okay? An overlay of the scaled known image and the questioned image can then be made in order to determine the relative alignment of other facial features that are consistent. This overlay of images is also referred to as the superimposition method and can be performed with video editing or image processing equipment. That would mean our Photoshop and our GIMP programs and whatever. Okay. A variation of the overlay approach is a photogrammetric one. Either side by side images and or the superimposition method. And when you put side by side, you can draw lines across from one image to the other, you know, that cross into the jaw lines, the pupil, the nasal bridge, etc. Now, for both the photogrammetric and overlay approach, the images must be of the same perspective. But the key difference is that an overlay allows one to view the length and width simultaneously, although viewing the lines in the photogrammetric approach leaves more to human perception as one looks across both images. Superimposition can appear to be doctoring of evidence if not properly explained, which we have done. Scaling implies changing the images to affect alignment, but the method is sound. And that's
Of course the method is sound. I mean, you know, why would anyone challenge it? It's obviously appropriate. I like your spelling it out, Larry, but it was obvious to me from the beginning that this was a sound methodology. There was no reason to doubt it. I'm very disappointed with the responses that Gary's going to continue to tell us coming from this conference by individuals who appear to be either methodologically unsophisticated or deliberately dissembling in denial, wanting to deny the evidence, which is so very forceful here.
Chance
has a clip now. He wants to show exactly what you're talking about here, Larry. Chance, am I right? You got it? Okay.
In a recent episode of The Real Deal on NBC, Larry Rivera created some overlays using the Ulchins photo. And this photo that you see here, you can see just barely in the back with the red circle around it, a man in the doorway. Enhanced and zoomed in, it looks a little bit more like this. Now, this guy right here is the man in question. A lot of people have said that it's Billy Lovelady, and some other people have commented that it's Lee Harvey Oswald. So Larry Rivera, he basically took the still frame from the door and known shots of Lee Harvey Oswald, known shots of Billy Lovelady, put them in an overlay, let them kind of create an image as you see them, basically having different levels of transparency. And the show went on for about 2 hours, and I know it's a lot sometimes for people to watch a whole show or to pass around a whole show of that length. So this is just a small clip to show you the first one. This one here is Doorway Man as a still frame with an overlay of Billy Lovelady. As you can see here, that isn't a perfect match, or it is noticeably different. The second one, this is using a photo of Lee Harvey Oswald with an overlay of Doorway Man, creating a much smoother transitioning image that we see here. Once again, you can check out the entire episode in the description below. Stay tuned to The Real Deal YouTube. It has all kinds of updates on this every Wednesday on the new JFK show. Thank you.
All right, Larry, go ahead and tell us what we got there, man.
Okay, what we did was we created a control animation which depicts the NOPD, and the DPD images, the mugshots of Lee Oswald, which when we lined everything up, everything came out perfect. The eyes, the interpupillary distance, the face, the shape of the face, the head, everything, the ears, the chin with the cleft, particular specific cleft that Lee Oswald had. And then what we did was we ran the experiment of comparing each one of those individually to the backyard photo. When we compared the New Orleans PD photo, which we prepared a special animation here, and we outlined the incredible protrusion on the right side of his head, which is the left one when you look at it from the front, and the amount of space there that protrudes is just incredible. That's why I call it like a pumpkin head.
So Larry, you're telling me the man in the back in the backyard photographs has a larger head than Lee Oswald?
Much, much larger. And this is something that Jack White, apparently he did such a fantastic job, you know, being the first one to really study these. However, he didn't have the technology to overlay the way that we did.
And using
the other the control images of the of the NOPD and the DPD, and the amount of the anomaly is just mind boggling. We have posted this, but I prepared.
You're saying the discrepancy between the authentic Oswald and how his cranium would have filled out the backyard man, and the actual backyard man is enormous, and it leaves no room for doubt that someone was standing in for Lee Oswald, just as he claimed. Just as he said to Will Fritz about when shown one of these photographs.
Well, yeah, but not only that, it proves that the doctoring of the photograph that they had to perform was what it did. It created a photograph or an image that was just physically impossible. But because the neck, the right side of the neck, just protrudes in a way that was probably a couple of inches, and then going around the ear extends probably another couple of inches, and then the head on that right side, left side, when you're looking at it from the front, is just totally amorphous. And when this just happened in the last couple of days, and I circulated that, Ralph has already posted it. Yeah, the one that has the red outline in the middle, in the when you run the animation, right? And I stayed on that one on the that's the fifth frame of the animation, and I kept it there for a couple of seconds so that our audience could appreciate the incredible amount of space there between one and the other, because obviously this indicates that this is not a symmetrical head. That one side was a lot larger. It just my term for that was sort of like a pumpkin head. And this all goes back to the same technology of this overlay technology that we have been using to restudy all of these images, and it's bearing a lot of fruit now.
Oh yeah, we're leaving the opposition in the dust. I mean, technologically, they don't have any idea how to deal with it, Larry. That's why you're getting these sweeping dismissals when Gary brings it up at this conference. They have no idea what to say about it. They don't know how to cope with it. They've got to hear from their experts, their handlers, what to say about it in the future. So Larry was there catching them with their pants down.
Yeah. Like Don said, you just can't have Lee in the doorway. That's for both sides of the aisle. All our books are not going to be worth anything. It just cannot be. So, one question before we let Don weigh in on all this. Larry, is the phone ringing off the hook with phone interviews from the JFK community about your new research?
No, not at all. In fact, I had some very interesting correspondence with Greg Burnham, and he was very kind in suggesting that I define the provenance of the photograph that I was using in the overlay, the man in the doorway, where Robert Groden has used that famous image called the absolute proof that we all have used for so many times. And Robert Groden had first published this in his book, The Search for Lee Harvey Oswald, published in 1995. Now, that is the provenance of our photograph, our control which in the jargon of facial recognition and forensic science is known as the probe. And the images that we use to test against the probe are called the gallery. So I'm very grateful for Greg that he pointed this out, that I needed to specify and identify from where this image had come from, the provenance of that image. And that's the answer to that. And as far as the specifics of the technique, well, you know, I spelled it out clearly in the paper. And now that we have this background on forensic facial recognition and forensic sciences, I don't think there's any doubt here on the technique. So
okay,
I'm very comfortable with it.
All right, Don, is the phone ringing off the hook for you as far as your 9/11 nuclear research?
Yeah, that gets general. That gets scoffed widely. Everybody denied. Very, very few people will talk about that. I was talking to you. I said, okay, nobody hates 9/11 truth more than the 9/11 truth movement. And nobody hates JFK truth more than the JFK research community.
Well, it just reaffirms, you know, what Gordon Duff said to me when I observed Gordon. I think half of those in the JFK community are working the other side. And Gordon said to me, no, Jim, it's 90%.
That's a damn lie. I'm telling you, it's a damn lie. It's 97%.
So it's fairly astonishing, the percentage is simply staggering.
Okay, here we go. Jim Morris, what did we have? A question mark here for him?
Oh, Mars is on the up and up. He may not understand the development, but I don't have any doubts about Jim.
Hey, okay. I had one question, Gary. I had one question for Larry before we get rolling on something else.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
Larry, have you compared Oswald before he went to the Soviet Union to Oswald either in New Orleans or Dallas?
That's a very good question, because now I think it's on the table.
We have a methodology we can use to resolve a lot of these questions about doppels. So far, whether the real Lee came back from the Soviet Union or not.
That's right. Because remember when Jack White did that collage with all
the
different
faces of Lee Harvey Oswald,
and I remember being at ASK 1993, and he had this big giant poster there. Yeah.
And now, Larry, you can start testing them one by one and see
exactly
if they are or not.
Exactly. That's a great point, Don. That's a great point.
It's an excellent suggestion.
It's probably going to be the next task here.
There we go.
I'm not that great at the photo analysis, but to me, the Lee that went to the Soviet Union does not look like the same guy that was arrested in Dallas. I thought the kid that went to the Soviet Union, his face was a little fatter and his neck was a little thicker.
Well, Don, we can now test the proposition.
Yeah. So I think that's well worth looking at, yeah.
Yeah, Don, you got to give him a little time, man. He's got more research to do than he has time left in his life.
Well, I think one of the most compelling observations by Armstrong was the thing about the magic tooth, that so-called magic tooth that the Lee Oswald in New Orleans had gone into that fight and lost a tooth.
Allegedly, yeah.
Right. And in a fight, and one of his buddies snapped a photograph of him in the classroom, and that was very, very clear that he was missing that tooth. And then when they exhumed the body in 1981, I believe, when Eddowes had the body exhumed, that tooth had never been lost. So that's always I've always wondered about that.
Well, Larry, more grist for your mill. You got a lot of work to do, my friend.
Yeah.
Jared, go back to the conference.
All right. Okay. Next up was Joan Mellon. All right.
I don't know that we need to even spend any time on Joan Mellon. She's completely subverted a big conference in Washington, D.C., financed by a very wealthy man. He'd flown out to Madison to have me set it up. I had some of the best people available involved here. And then she showed up at the last minute and managed to torpedo the whole thing. It was terrible. That was Mellon's doing.
Well, here's what happened.
I got one thing to say about Joan Mellon here, and it would be from the protocols, Protocol 12. In the third rank, we shall set up our own, to all appearance, opposition, which, in at least one of its organs, will present what looks like the very antipodes to us. Our real opponents at heart will accept this simulated opposition as their own and will show us their cards.
Man.
Well, I think a lot of cards are being shown here.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, it's like a Mary's mosaic. I think this Oswald doorway is indeed a litmus test, just as Gary was suggesting.
Yeah.
And when I dipped it in Mr. Mars's jug, I'm not sure of the color yet. We're still letting it drip on the ground. All right. Now, interesting story about Joan Mellon. She gave her story riding the coattails of Jim Garrison all the way, and there was this lady there that did know about the JFK show, and she kept asking, what's the book to read? I mean, if there was one book, she said, give me two books. I said, okay, you want Jim Fester's book? We didn't go to the moon either. And I said, and the second one is Michael Collins Piper. All right. So she said, Michael Collins Piper, huh? Then
you didn't mean Murder in Dealey Plaza, Gary, because the Moon book, of course, isn't about JFK.
Now, she wanted to know about other things, too.
Oh, I see. Okay. Go ahead.
So okay. We gave her that one. However, just by chance, now she didn't know anything, she walked out into the book lobby, and there was Joan Mellon. He walked up to her and said, what do you think of Michael Collins Piper's book? And she came back and said, that lady got really mad at me and very upset. What did I say? I said, well, what did you say? I said, what do you think of Michael Collins Piper's book? She says, I don't talk about other people's books. And besides that, you know.
It's Michael terrible. Besides that, it's terrible.
She doesn't talk about other people's books.
How ridiculous.
Okay, so I guess Russ Baker was the next one that came along. He was, I don't know what to say about him. All I did was look on his website. It's all mainstream 9/11. Maybe just go off the reservation just a hair or so. So there you go. Any comments on Russ Baker? The one that did the book?
He does not and never has impressed me one iota.
Yeah, he did Family of Secrets, which is a sort of a John Hankey light, more or less.
Yeah,
I've heard him. I guess I haven't been that enamored with his work. So, mm-hmm.
Okay. So then we had Sarah Peterson and Katina Zachary. Like I said before, it seemed I talked to Lauren. Well, I best not say that. I don't know what they said. I mean, I was there, but I don't know what they said. All right. Then up next was Roger Stone, and the only thing that I can see about him is he was really hardcore in with the boys at one time. We're talking about the mainstream, New York Times. Well, I don't know if these are exact newspapers, but did a little research there on the fly, and just don't know yet about him. I didn't really talk to him. So he did stand up and say that Phil Nelson's book is the bomb and he is the man and all that kind of stuff. However, Larry's had something to say with Phil Nelson. I'm not exactly sure. So anybody want to comment on Roger Stone?
Well, I think he I've heard him give interviews about Nixon and some of that stuff. You know, I thought, hey, I should track this down later. And I never did get around to it. And
right.
I thought he
was a right-hand man. He was a right-hand man to Richard Nixon. He was working in the Nixon White House. I mean, he was in deep. So now he's busted all the way to the truther side. Okay.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I'm just saying, you know, there might be a couple of gold, you know, nuggets of gold sitting in there somewhere that you may not have tripped over otherwise.
Right. But keep in mind, we're in search of 100% truthers now. Okay.
Well, okay, so if you were going to say that, then I guess the line to say about Roger Stone then would be, in the front rank will stand organs of an official character. They will always stand guard over our interests, and therefore their influence will be comparatively insignificant. Okay.
Is that also from the protocols?
Yeah, that is. Yeah. So that means
he's got a poster.
I've got a TV behind me that serves double, you know, another purpose as a computer monitor, and I've got the protocols up on the other monitor there.
Okay, I have to tell my story about Robert Groden. I busted my butt to get that guy on Skype. Man, there are so many problems when you're trying to do a Skype cast. It really was. So I've really worked hard as a roadie, as a sound engineer, and a video guy to get Robert Groden to come in there and propagandize everyone there.
And what happened?
All right, what happened was he came on and started talking the usual stuff, and the only thing that I have to report about it is that at least 10 minutes was reported on how those people that keep bringing up the Z-Film alteration are just not doing justice. I have to say he was better than when he was on Black Op Radio, where he called us kooks and fairy tales. It wasn't that blatant at this conference because Robert couldn't see the audience. We could see him, but he couldn't see the audience.
Yeah, but adopting that attitude in 2015 is simply loopy. I mean, that's total denial. That means you're no longer in contact with reality. That means you've lost track of the evidence or you never understood it to begin with.
Well, he hasn't read chapter 14 of Douglas Horn's Inside the ARRB, number four.
And that was already 2009, Larry.
Yeah, I know.
As somebody once observed, it's very difficult to make a man understand something that he's paid handsomely to not understand.
That's right.
I think that the technology has passed him by, Jim.
Well, your discovery of the Newcomb tapes, for crying out loud, Larry.
That's right.
Unexploited evidential resource that you have developed masterfully. And it's utterly inconsistent with his position. I mean, for God's sake, hasn't Judith put two and two together yet that this was the guy who told the HSCA that the man in the doorway was not Lee Oswald, but Billy Lovelady, when she herself, using the same evidence, came to the opposite conclusion? She's got to understand something is not right.
And not only that, and not let us not forget that mysterious trip to Denver with Kenneth Bruton and that very dubious statement that he had Billy Lovelady sign, supposedly, which we have already verified and had analyzed by a professional forensic calligrapher and expert to have been totally falsified. So what can I say?
All right, well, the other 10 minutes that he put aside during his presentation was Billy Lovelady was the doorman. It's been proven 100 times. And these crazy people, he didn't say crazy, he says, but there is just no question about it. It's Billy Lovelady in the doorway. So wherever Robert Groden goes, that is two major points that he takes a lot of time to make that point.
Now, the Zapruder film is authentic, and it was Billy Lovelady, not Lee Oswald, in the doorway. And he's been blown out of the water again and again and again. I mean, this is pathetic that he continues to shovel this malarkey as embarrassing.
Totally. Judith,
even Judith has to put two and two together at some point.
Gary, well, did anybody ask Robert Groden about the limo turn from Elm onto Houston, or from Houston onto Elm? I mean, it's missing in the extant Zapruder film. So if that was a legit film, how come we don't see the limo turning around the corner?
Right, because Zapruder said he started filming when the limo came into view and continued filming until it disappeared under the triple underpass.
Yeah, well, even Zapruder himself said he kept filming the whole time and never stopped.
Right. That's right. I'm quoting Zapruder.
Yep.
And not only that, I want to question what his qualifications originally were to have been named to the HSCA when sure there were many, many, many other...
Consultant, Larry, that's a very good question. How did this obscure figure of whom no one had ever heard turn up having this extraordinarily sensitive assignment of figuring out whether it was or was not Lee Oswald in the doorway?
Or the Zapruder film.
For example, where where unfortunately
he was the first one to present it on national television.
Oliver Stone fell into the hands of Robert Groden and depended upon him as an advisor in creating JFK.
Now bear in mind also, Jim, that the image overlay that we used for our man in the doorway thing is the same image that Groden has used to supposedly identify Billy Lovelady as doorman.
Yes. So, yes.
And he hasn't used any scientific basis to identify him. He's just saying that it's him.
I don't think he understands science at all, Larry.
So, you know.
I think he's a scientific illiterate.
Right. Let's put our chips on the table, you know, and define what is what.
All right. So, Don, what protocol of Zion does Robert Groden fall under?
Okay. So I guess he was on the House Select Committee of Assassinations. So in the second rank will be the semi-official organs whose part it will be to attack the tepid and indifferent.
That's him.
Killing us.
You're going to only want him to attack the tepid and indifferent because
he
can't handle the truth.
The correct.
Okay, on to Ed Haslam. Ed Haslam was the
great guy,
100% truth teller that we had at this conference. He had some new stuff on Chauncey Holt, which mirrored everything Dr. Fester's ever said. He actually referenced Dr. Fester at least 3 times during his Chauncey Holt. So what it looks like to me is that he's steering away from the doctor's marriage monkey, me and Lee, though he did promote it during one talk, but he's writing a complete book on Chauncey Holt. And I did get a chance to talk to him while I was setting up his microphone. I said, does Chauncey Holt seem to be the real deal? He said, it sure looks like it.
Excellent. I'm very pleased to hear that. Ed Haslam's a good man.
One of the most astounding revelations of Chauncey in his book, that's really, really amazing, is the fact that the CIA had a safe house in Acapulco where George Ball was one of the main cogs, you know, in getting all of these operatives over there to cool down after the assassination, you know, and that kind of thing. So, obviously, had a lot of really good.
Where else would you rather be after you took out the 35th president of the United States? Acapulco does it for me. Pina coladas in this beautiful sky.
Mai Tais.
Bikinis and all that. Yeah, there you go.
All right. Okay.
Now, Gary, I was going to say Ed Haslam is a really good speaker. He does a lot of, you know, I guess I would have sat through even a Joan Mellon if I would get to hear Ed Haslam live, I guess. So,
yeah. Now you get to leave the room and come back later. You don't have to sit there. You can go in the lounge area.
Well, if I was there, I'd have to sit through it as painful as it might be. I'd have to.
I know. It was good for me. I've given up my faith in conferences. I'm going to be resigning from the JFK community minus you three guys. You know, it was really just like Ed Tatro.
Gary, you want to stay with the OIC, my friend.
Well, yeah, that, but look, there ain't no honey. I'm telling you, I can only think of a couple of people besides you three. Judy Baker, who, a confused one, who we need to have a talk with. And guess what? I'm doing sound in Dallas, so I'm going to have to sit through them all again. But all these questions you have, we need to find out. You know,
it's amazing. They have these conferences and they don't invite people like Larry Rivera or me or others who could shed light on the most recent developments. We aren't invited. We're not going on Black Op Radio. We're not being invited to Dallas either. I mean, it's a step.
I got something to tell you. We ain't going to be invited to anything anymore. We are the outcasts. We are the riffraff. We are the posse. And I don't care. I don't need anybody else. If I got Larry Rivera and Dr. Fester on my team, man, that's like having Peyton Manning.
We're doing what we can, Gary. The four of us are trying. We're doing the cutting edge research. It may take years for the rest of the community to catch up with it, but it's mostly deliberate. They don't want to be confronted with the facts. Their minds are already made up.
Yeah.
All right, we got just a couple more since we're running short on time. They had a fellow named Todd Elliott. He talked about Rose Jeremy. There's really not a lot out there, and I couldn't see any problems with his book. It was his only JFK book, and he concentrated on Rose Jeremy, and I couldn't see any problem there. We had Daniel Hopsicker, which one of my friends in the audience was doing research on these speakers, and he does bring up Barry Seal, George Bush being involved in drugs. He also talks about 9/11, how Muhammad Atta were all in strip clubs, and they were in a little town in Florida that only old people lived in. But then again, when you start looking at it, he does not endorse Jim Fetzer's 9/11 stuff at all.
I guaranteed he doesn't endorse any of my stuff on 9/11. Guaranteed.
This is Hopsicker.
Yeah.
Yeah, Daniel Hopsicker.
Yep. I mean, nobody at A&E 9/11 will touch my stuff. The crickets.
Don, we are the litmus test. They are failing.
All right, so Don, you're the only one that even knows who Daniel Hopsicker is. Go ahead and tell us what you think.
Well, he's from the Washington.
Fall of Zion, he would fall on it.
He's now in the third rank, but they moved him from the front rank because he was working for the Washington Post, I believe. So he was working for an organ of official character, but his influence was comparatively insignificant. So I think they've moved him over now to where he can have a bigger influence, but maybe now he's a conspiracy theorist, but he's got weight because he's got the mainstream media background.
All right, then we had St. John Hunt. All he really did was introduce people. He didn't have a speech. Judy Baker talked about cancer, which was very, very enlightening. I'm going to get a copy for all of us because we don't want to go down that way. We want to do our best and stay healthy. So, Larry, did you have anything else about the backyard photos or any before we pass around the last final comments?
No. I believe we have covered just about everything we needed to cover, and I appreciate Don's suggestion, which I'm definitely going to start working on as soon as possible, because I think that's a very valid proposition here on doing overlays of all of the photographs of Lee Harvey Oswald and see what we come up with.
Yeah, Don, I said, Mr. Tatro, why don't you come on our show? He said, well, I pretty much shied away from radio, but come to find out, he was on one of the biggest shows. That Seamus Coogan visits his show quite often.
Yeah, he was on the Dallas Action. I was listening to it last spring, so this was a few months ago. I heard him on there a couple times.
Well, then if he can go on there,
who could pass up an interview with Seamus Coogan?
But don't have no time for Dr. Fetzer and all that Oswald in the Doorway Z film silliness.
And stay tuned. Yeah, I got a PowerPoint coming up. I don't know if we'll get to it next week. Stay tuned for some more of the whodunit.
Good.
Okay, last question, Don, and we're out of here. What protocol do we fall under?
We're not. Okay, I'll look that one up because I'm sure we're in there somewhere. But
you haven't seen ours up in there yet.
No, we're the actual opposition. So
okay, Don,
go ahead. Yeah,
Gary, say
okay.
Thank See you next Gary. Week. This is the new JFK show. New JFK show number 78. We're gone. We'll be right back.